Hello. So my name is Matthew Johnson, and I'm here to talk to you today about how Microsoft Research has joined the worlds of artificial intelligence and Minecraft through the new Malmo platform. Before I get started, I'd just like to thank my collaborator and colleague, Katja Hoffman, who's lead researcher on the project, David Bignall and Tim Hutton, who helped me with the engineering work of bringing Project Malmo to the world, and of course, the entire Malmo team, past and present. So, AI is a pretty hot topic, I think it's safe to say. It's in the news. It's doing lots of exciting things for good reason, and people are excited about it because all of a sudden we're able to do amazing things with AI and computer vision, speech recognition, machine translation. And Microsoft Research has been at the center of that. We've been at the forefront of computer science research, and indeed AI research, for our entire 25-year history. And so we're, of course, extremely excited, given things like Satya's keynote last week announcing this new AI and research division, to see the company focusing its efforts in this area. But all the hype aside, if you actually go and talk to an expert in this area, if you go and talk to an AI expert and say, how can I use AI in my business? How can I use artificial intelligence to make things happen? What's next? What's the next big thing in AI? They're all going to ask you the same question. What do you mean by artificial intelligence? What is artificial intelligence? It's a very important question. It's an old question. It's been being asked for a very long time. So Alan Turing, maybe you can consider him the father of computer science, he was fascinated by this question of machine intelligence. And when he was working at the University of Manchester in the 50s, he wrote a paper called Computational Machines and Intelligence. And it opens with these words, "I propose to consider the question, can machines think?" He then proceeds to describe what we now know as his famous Turing test, or the imitation game, whereby three players, one of whom is a machine, have a conversation. And if the machine can fool the other players into thinking that it's human, then it's intelligent. And this is because Turing believed something very important, which is that intelligent behavior is what humans do. We are the standard by which intelligence must be measured. So that begs, of course, the following question, what can humans do? And when the answer is, I don't have to tell you, we can do a lot of stuff. We can learn multiple languages, we can navigate complex environments, we can organize and plan events with thousands of people, we can remember things that we've seen in years past, we can recognize a person that we haven't seen in 3 decades. We can do amazing things with our intelligence. And the key thing is that all those amazing things we can do, the next day we can learn a new thing and another thing, and everything that we learn informs everything else. Our intelligence is amazing that way. So how do computers stack up in comparison to what we're able to do? Well, actually rather well. They've been doing quite well in recent years. There have been some amazing advances. Take, for example, machine vision. So here's an image. As many things in it, has some people. They have faces, they have gender and body shapes and poses within the scene. There's some tables, some couches, some cushions. There's lighting conditions that are lighting up the various people within the scene. People have expressions on their faces. They're happy, sad, whatever. There are many things in this image, and each thing that I just described, face detection, illuminance, photometrics, object recognition, there are expert systems to do all of these things. Take, for example, face detection. If you remember having a handheld camera back in the 90s, all of a sudden this weird square started showing up around people's faces. That was face detection happening in hardware. Since then, we've had face detection happening on mobile phones, used to guide the way the mobile phones take photographs and take high-quality photographs. And that's just one of the many things that can be done in computer vision. Take, for example, object recognition, which is an extremely hard problem. So here we have a common benchmark. It's called the ImageNet benchmark. It has thousands of classes, 1,000 images per class. And these are incredibly difficult images. You can kind of look at some of them. If you look at the handheld computer category, we have all sorts of different kinds of computers there of different shapes. Some of them are consumer photographs, some are people, photographs of people using them, some are professionally taken, some are amateur. Same thing, there's 30 different breeds of dog. This is one of the cuter ones, so that's why I included it. Amazing amounts of, kind of variance between them, but being able to recognize these different breeds, and some of them have humans and their handlers in it. Some of them are very difficult photographs. And then, look at this teapot category. So yes, we have some standard teapots. You also have a shelf with bunches of different teapots on it of all different shapes and sizes. You have a teapot that's being used as a vase, has flowers in it. And there's another teapot that has reflection in it, because it has a polished surface, of a wine bottle and a person and a few other things. So these are very difficult images. And what's exciting is that until quite recently, Computers were not very good at this, and all of a sudden they're now better than humans. So this is the ResNet system. It's the best system in the world for this particular task. It was developed at Microsoft Research, and it uses an extremely deep, what's called neural net, which is like a machine brain, to recognize these images. So what is another area that computers are doing rather well in? So speech recognition, machine translation, speech synthesis. Computers are doing amazing jobs at this, again, using deep learning. So a great example of this is Skype Translator, which allows people to have conversations in different languages with real-time translation using speech. So that's for 8 languages, and it can do text for up to 50. And this is, again, driven by research that happened in Microsoft Research in speech recognition, machine translation, and speech synthesis. And there's many other things besides. So for example, reading. Computers are really good at reading now. So every single search engine in the world is basically reading the web multiple times every week, every single page, and marking down the important topics, the important things that are on each page that you might be interested in, so that when you go into a search engine and make a natural language query like, what is the age of the universe, it can return you pages that answer that question. This is amazing. We take it for granted. But it's amazing, given the billions of pages available, that it's able to do that effectively and quickly every single time. Take, for example, planning. Another thing we take for granted is the ability to get from point A to point B using a GPS device or your mobile phone. This is, again, a very difficult problem that uses artificial intelligence to plan complex journeys through a routed network with various constraints, you know, for example, traffic conditions or type of transport being used. We even have machines that can compose music in the style of Bach and then play it on pianos. It's an exciting time. The thing about all these systems that I've just described is they're expert systems. What I mean by that is that they do one thing. They do it really well, better than humans in some circumstances, but they do one thing. So the system that's able to play Bach on the piano doesn't know how to plan your trip, and the system that plans your trip doesn't know how to recognize images and so on and so on. Each one is an expert and able to do a single thing. What we want is a general system, a system that does what humans do. It's very clear for us now that what humans do is not the different tasks. What humans do is learning. What we do is the ability to generalize, the ability to transfer what we know from one area or domain of expertise into another. And so that is what we want to do. But how can we build a system like that? Well, using the techniques we've used past, using data, supervision, so forth, can we build a system like this in the same way? And the answer is probably not. So if you look, for example, at ImageNet, you have 1,000 categories, 1,000 images per category, less than a megapixel per image. So it's about 197 gigabytes worth of data. Take your average teenager. Your average teenager in the 18 years of their life is going to see somewhere upwards of 7 billion images, because you can kind of pretend that the eye is a camera. It isn't really, but for the purpose of the back-of-the-envelope calculation here, we can pretend. And they're able to recognize around 20,000 categories, and that turns out to be about 150 petabytes of data. And that's 6 orders of magnitude more. So just an ungodly amount more of data. And you have to understand that ImageNet, as great as it is, those 1 million images had to be each labeled by a human. It took years to build. And so scaling that up to the problem of general intelligence is probably not going to work. And there's another thing. Those images were unlabeled. No one was sitting there at every single second of that teenager's life and saying what they were seeing. Almost all of those images were just seen and processed by the brain, and the brain learned from them without any other input aside from the natural rewards that it was receiving by interacting with its environment. So the question is, how can we build a system that can learn the way humans can and hopefully have the kind of general intelligence that we have? This is where Minecraft comes in. So the real world is a very expensive place to do experimentation. You, of course, could build a robot that can walk around the world and see things and listen to things and experience things and try to interact with the world. But in order to get 18 years of experience with that robot, it would take 18 years, 18 extremely expensive years. Now, what's great about Minecraft is that, yes, it's a simplified version of the world. Yes, it has a simplified physics and geometry. But it has a lot of characteristics that are actually incredibly helpful for training something to become intelligent. So the agents within the world are moving around. They have what's called ego motion. They're embodied within a thing that's in the world and see a partial part of the world through a 3D projection, similar to the way that we do. They're able to interact with other agents in a collaborative fashion to achieve common goals. There's an infinite number of tasks already available because the world itself is extremely adaptable and flexible and can be modified very easily. And the worlds themselves are procedurally generated, which means they're functionally infinite in terms of exploration. And because it's a simulated world, we can actually run multiple different worlds in parallel in the cloud. We can speed up the simulations. That 18 years takes 18 months. We can run the same experiences with multiple different algorithms and see how they perform relative to each other. So it's a wonderful thing for doing AI experimentation, and this is why we built Project Malmo. So Project Malmo, which I'm going to talk about now for a little bit and give you some insight into how it works and how it can be used, is an open source project. You can go download it today. I encourage you to. It's a ton of fun to play around with. And that's actually kind of why we've put it out there. We have hundreds of researchers already using it. It's already driving the conversation of how AI is being built. We have thousands of enthusiasts, kids, avid programmers, Minecraft fans, who are downloading it and playing around with building their own artificial intelligence in the world of Minecraft. We don't just want to democratize the usage of AI. We don't just want to democratize the ability to use various frameworks that have been developed by experts. We really want everyone to learn how to program AI. We want everyone to learn how to build the next intelligences that are going to be helping us in the years ahead. So how does Project Malmo work? It has two main parts. So the Minecraft game has the ability to be modded. So we've built a mod that runs within the Minecraft process. It observes the state of the world. It knows where things are, what pixels are being shown to the particular agent. It knows all sorts of different variables about the state of the world and where the agent is. It's able to expose all of these, along with programmable rewards about a task to be achieved, to the API, which wraps this interaction. The API makes it easy to use your user code to build your AI agent. It exposes the observations and rewards and also allows the ability to send commands back into the mod that close the loop and allow the agent to move around and interact with the world around it. We allow user code in a multitude of languages, C, C++, Java, Python, Torch, actually, and all .NET languages. And basically, I'm going to show you a sample agent right here. So this is your first Malmo agent, if you want to think of it that way. It's written in Python. And it does some very simple things. First off, it creates an agent host. This is going to help it manage the relationship with the world that it's interacting with. It then creates a mission. A mission is a combination of a world description, what the world should look like, and a task to be achieved within that environment. It then creates a mission record. Now, this is a very important thing for research because it allows researchers to go back and examine and evaluate what happened in every single round of interaction that the agent has with the world, and then analyze that and hopefully learn from it. It then creates this world state loop where it sees as long as the mission is learning, as long as the mission's running, it receives the most recent world state. It analyzes the rewards that it's received, the observations it's seen about the world, and then takes action. So this agent obviously doesn't care what it sees. It's just running and jumping in a circle. But you can imagine that using this very simple programming language, you can actually, in programming interface for Python and other languages, you can create quite complex agents. So here's an example of a mission record. It's a simple XML file, and it describes an environment and a task. So in this case, it describes this particular environment. There's a cobblestone block that the agent's sitting on. There's a cliff that's been created through the lava, and then there's a blue goal block at the end. And the idea is that the agent has to walk along the cliff, avoiding the lava, to get to the goal. That's the goal that's been described. And you can see in the XML where that's being described, the cuboids that describe the different shapes, the blocks that describe the start and end, and the item that will indicate that the agent has successfully completed the mission. And then a time limit has been, they have to complete it within, looks like, 10 seconds. And so what's great about having a system like this is that it allows for collaboration. So we have a large community of researchers. They need to know how their algorithms and how their approaches compare to each other. So what they've done is they are going actively and creating mission files in XML that they can then share with their colleagues, establish benchmarks of different tasks that need to be achieved. And we literally have hundreds of these already, and anyone can create these. It's a lot of fun. And we have things, for example, building a shelter and a sustainable system. We have navigation challenges where you have to navigate very complex environments and avoid obstacles. We have exploring an underground cavern and trying to find where things are, and many other things besides of increasing and lesser difficulty. And what this is doing is it's driving what the future of AI is going to be. It's driving what kinds of tasks people are going to try to solve. And this is very much unlike all of the kind of tasks that AI is being thrown at, because it's really an entire thing. The idea is that by learning how to achieve one of these tasks, like, for example, avoiding the lava and being able to walk along the cliff successfully, the agent doesn't just learn how to solve that task. The agent learns how to navigate. They learn something about what to avoid, what causes danger, and that information is going to follow it as it learns how to do other tasks. The same way that when you learn how to run to play a sport, you now know how to run forever. When you go to learn another sport, you know how to run. You don't have to relearn running. So in the same way, we want to allow our agents to transfer their knowledge from one task to another. So what's next? Now that we have this platform, what can we do? Well, in order to explain that, I need to give you a little bit more information about how AI works, how machine learning actually happens, how the sausage is made. So if you look on the right-hand side of the diagram, you have what the current state is for almost every artificially intelligent system that gets built. There are basically two main points where human intelligence enters in. The first one is humans go and gather a bunch of inputs, for example, a bunch of images or sound files, and then for each single input, they label what the output should be that the machine learning algorithm should learn to produce. And they do that again and again for vast quantities of data, like I said, you know, for the ImageNet task, a million images with all the objects in them. And so the machine receives all of this information, all of these inputs and all of these outputs, and then the algorithm learns how to accurately map input to output. So that's the first way that human time and effort goes into training artificially intelligent systems. The second way is that once the system has produced an output, a human has to determine what to do with it. Let me give you an example. So remember I was talking about how various different bits of computer vision can be used to create better photographs, face detection, photometric correction, so forth. Each of those systems, the face detection, the detection of different geometry within the scene to determine where to create focus, the photometrics, the lighting, all of those expert systems, each of them create an output individually on their own, and then human-engineered heuristics decide how to combine them to create the final image. So that's the state of the art. That's how things work. It's generally called supervised learning, and it has had amazing results. And so I don't want to downplay it. There's a role for supervised learning in the future of AI. It's an extremely helpful and useful tool, but it's hugely labor-intensive. It requires large quantities of time from humans, and that's expensive. It requires large amounts of engineering in order to build these systems. Things like the face detection system or object recognition take years to engineer and build and get to the point where they're at human levels of quality. So what's the alternative? Well, in the alternative is something called interactive learning. Here, you build an artificially intelligent system that is able to learn from very simple rewards that it receives from its environment. So to go back to that photo example that I was saying earlier, instead of building all these expert systems and engineering how to combine them, you build a simple system that does a transform from the input image to the output image, and then you ask the user to say whether it was a good photo or a bad photo. So all the human has to do is say whether they liked it or not, and the system over time will learn what that person likes. Now that system very well could learn how to do face detection and photometric correction and all the other things that we built in by hand, but it could also learn things we would never expect. And most importantly, it can learn how to adapt itself and make itself specific to individual users. So it can learn the preferences of different people and adapt itself in a way that's personalized. So we think that learning like this, it's very similar to how we learn. It's also going to open up new categories of experience for people. It's going to open up new possibilities for what artificial intelligence can be used for. So obviously, we've built Project Malmo to be the ideal system for learning about how to do interactive learning. It works in exactly the way I just described. The agent receives observations and rewards and takes actions. And by essentially changing the task and the reward that's given, you can change the behavior of the agent and teach it to do new things. So just to give you a sense of how this is done today, so how you would actually build an interactive learning system, I'm going to talk to you about reinforcement learning, which is one of the most common techniques used to build systems like this. So the idea about reinforcement learning is that the system is going to learn through trial and error. It's never told what it's supposed to do. It just gets a negative reward when it does something wrong and a positive reward when it does something right. So take, for example, the cliff walking task from earlier. So we have the agent, they have to avoid the lava and get from the beginning all the way to the end. Now at the beginning, they know nothing. All they observe is where they are, represented as a single number that says which grid square that they're currently standing on. That's the only observation that it receives. And it receives a negative reward when it falls into the lava, and it receives a positive reward when it reaches the goal and gets the diamond. So, in the beginning, it falls into the lava a lot. This is what you'd expect. It doesn't understand lava, it doesn't know that lava's bad, it doesn't know that falling into the lava causes bad things to happen. It's just exploring its environment, and it's going to do that a lot. So the question is, how does the agent take that experience of falling into the lava and learn from it? How does it turn that into something that it can act on and change? So if you look at what the agent's able to do, they have a state, which is the grid that they're currently on, and they can move left or right, backwards or forwards. So what the agent's going to try to do is to learn what action is best at any particular state. So at the beginning, is moving forward good? Is moving right good? It's going to try it through trial and error and find it. And the way that it's able to do this is through something called Q learning. So it learns a Q value, which indicates the expected reward of taking that action. So if it knows that falling into the lava happens when they take this action, they know the expected reward is very low because they're going to die. But if they survive, they don't know necessarily what the final reward is going to be, but they know that it's probably going to be better than falling into the lava. So over time, they learn how to navigate the space successfully, and they do this by building what's called a Q table. So if you look here in this diagram, you have the agent on the left. You have two Q tables. The first Q table is the Q table after the agents had two trials of trying to solve the task. In those trials, they moved forward and died, and moved backward and died. And so they've learned, you can see the colored circles, red is bad, green is good, yellow is okay. It's learned that moving forward and moving backward are bad. As it continues to explore the space, as it continues to try different things, it explores different parts of this Q table. It learns which actions are good and bad and how to navigate the space. So you'll see here it building the table in real time. So you'll notice that it's following a safe path that it's found until it gets to the place where it has a chance to take an action it hasn't taken before, and then it learns whether it's good or bad. This is going to run for a while. This typically takes, you can speed this up, obviously. It's been slowed down for us to watch. But it learns in a matter of minutes how to navigate this task. And the whole time, the important thing is that no point did anyone put in any pathfinding, no one put in anything that allowed it to recognize where the goal was and try to get to it. It's learned entirely through experience. So here's what what it looks like when it's learned the entire Q table. So you can see that it's learned up there at the top left that that's how you get to the goal, and the goodness of that result is slowly bleeding out into the rest of the table, so it lines the ideal path, and it's now able to get there without dying every single time. And so this is a very simple example of how something like reinforcement learning can be used to train these systems. Now, in this case, the observation was just a single grid square, a single location on the grid. However, the observation could really be anything, including the very pixels of the screen itself. And of course, building systems that are able to see the same way humans can and make intelligent decisions is a thing that we're very interested in building. So in terms of where we're going in our research and what we're trying to build, a lot of what we're doing is based on reinforcement learning, like I've just described. In particular, the way that reinforcement learning interacts with what's called deep learning. So deep learning is very kind of large, very complex neural nets that mimic the way that the human brain has certain subsystems that are able to deal with certain kinds of input. And they're trained in a very similar way to the way how we think the brain is trained. And they're able to do amazing things in speech recognition, speech synthesis, and machine vision, like I mentioned earlier. And they can actually be combined with reinforcement learning to create very exciting new solutions to these sorts of unbounded, unsupervised problems. And of course, the result of working within Minecraft and within the domain of Minecraft is that we can do some pretty exciting things surrounding collaboration. So because multiple agents are able to be in the same world at the same time, because Minecraft natively supports collaboration between people, we can explore whole areas of artificial intelligence research that have never been possible before. We can explore what happens when two agents are given the same task and have to work together. We can explore what happens when a human and an AI have to collaborate to make something happen. These, we think, are the really interesting use cases that are going to be increasingly relevant to our world and something that we can explore in this new platform. And of course, coordinating people who are working on the same task requires some kind of language, and so we can learn how language is created, how it evolves over time, whether AI will learn how to talk to each other using language if they're given the ability, whether that language will follow the same kinds of rules. These are questions we've never been able to answer before, and we're excited to do the research that's going to make it possible. And finally, another thing that Minecraft handles particularly well is what's called hierarchical dependency. So if you want to craft something in the world, it often has a hierarchy of things that need to be crafted in order to craft that thing, and it goes kind of all the way down to very basic materials that are easy to gather. And solving problems like this is an open question, how to build a system that's able to handle these complex, learn these complex hierarchies, and then utilize them in order to achieve very complex goals. And so this is another thing that we're very interested in exploring in this platform along with our partners. So, as a species, humans have a long history of creating intelligent partnerships with each other, with intelligent animals that we found in nature. And so perhaps it's not surprising at all that we're beginning to form partnerships with artificial intelligence. Every day, you use a supercomputer in your pocket to talk to artificially intelligent search engines that tell you things you didn't know before, to take great photographs, to plan a trip. AI is removing language barriers. It's helping doctors diagnose cancer, helping scientists discover new materials and processes, conduct completely novel experiments. In the years ahead, you're going to use a digital assistant to help you in your personal life and in your work life. It's going to help you navigate the complex and wild digital landscape in which we're currently living, and domesticate it a bit. In Project Malmo, we're trying to create a new kind of artificial intelligence, one that learns from experience, one that learns your preferences and is able to adapt over time, and we hope eventually approach a kind of intelligence similar to our own. We're incredibly excited about what the future holds. And we at Microsoft Research in Cambridge are proud to be part of Microsoft's efforts to build a better world through AI and to empower every person and every organization on this planet to do more. Thank you.